Good morning. I find this topic, this discussion, very humbling in a couple of ways. It's a humbling topic because the consequences are so significant, literally life and death, and literally deciding who lives and who dies. It's hard to imagine many issues with more gravity, with more importance. So the topic is inherently humbling. But I feel all the more humbled that I don't really feel qualified to address this room on this topic. Everyone in this room deals with it more practically, with more experience than I have. And I really feel very humbled in addressing this crowd to talk about a subject such as this. And I can only hope to maybe turn it around. But I think the topic itself is one which calls upon a certain humility. It's one where the greatest of our poskim have often ended their tshuvos with sentences such as, we don't really have a clear path, we don't really have a clear policy, and therefore perhaps the best approach that we can take is one of raising questions, one of pointing out issues, bringing attention to some sources and to some principles that we find in the literature, talking about them, trying to consider how they can be interpreted, and in doing so, perhaps taking the perspective of a student more than an authority. So in that capacity, coming to you as a student, I feel a little more comfortable doing. So that's what I'd like to do this morning, is talk a little bit from a student's perspective of what some of the literature tells us, what some of the sources that we find, what perspective they shed on this issue, maybe throw some questions out to the distinguished audience, and hopefully leave us with some topics to think about, some ideas, some perspectives to take into our mind as we try to consider some of these issues. And in my mind, the whole topic is very comparable in some ways and parallels in some ways a topic which is more day-to-day for those of us who are not doctors, who are not emergency room physicians and the like, and that is the question of how we allocate resources in some other areas of life, such as that of tzedaka, how we allocate our limited resources when it comes to giving charity. So there as well, we have a question, again, that's a little more commonplace. It's not necessarily as dramatic as the question of saving lives in the emergency room, but it has some overlaps, not only in the fact, as we'll see, that there are overlapping sources, and in some cases, sources where it's a question which context they belong in this context, they belong in that context, but also it involves the allocation of resources in a setting where there is much ambiguity. And there is much that we can't say definitely. And in the end of the day, it is going to call upon our judgment and our discretion. But in both cases, the question of how we give out our tzedaka and how we give out our expertise and our skills and our abilities when trying to save lives directly, in both cases, it's going to end up involving a lot of judgment and a lot of discretion. And there's very little we can do to take that away. There's very little we can do to give definitive answers that are going to change that bottom line. What we try to do is that we hope that our discretion, the judgment that we use in these situations, will be a discretion that is informed by halakhic sources, that is educated by the halakhic values, so that the decisions that we make are not simply our best guess, but are the product of a serious reflection and education through the values of the Torah, while at the same time, still at the end of the day, reflecting a certain discretion. So to that extent, I think it's comparable to discussions that we find in the context of tzedaka. I'll mention as well that when we talk about some of the values in that context, let's say in the context of tzedaka, so one of the ideas that's valuable to keep in mind is that there are two different perspectives that we're coming from. But on the one hand, we're coming from the perspective that we are trying to accomplish the most with our tzedaka money. In general, chesed is a mandate of the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha, that we should help each other out, that we should make the biggest impact that we can on the lives of those who need us. So that's one goal that we have. And we see some things through that prism. And at the same time, there's a parallel but different goal. There's the goal of the halachta bidracha, that we are told that we are meant to be like God. And the Gemara says, what does it mean to be like God? It means to be engaged in acts of kindness, mahu racham v'chanan, afata racham v'chanan, just as He is compassionate and merciful. So too you should be that way, just as He engages in acts of chesed, so too you should be that way. So we have two different goals, and they're not at odds with each other, but sometimes which one we emphasize brings us to different directions. Or sometimes the same direction for different reasons. To give an example from the world of staka, so there was a discussion that the poskim and the earlier sources had. A person has limited money to give out for staka, just like he has limited resources in this area. So, in a very broad sense, he could do two things. He could invest all the donations in one place, where he'll have a big impact, will make a big splash. Or he could spread the wealth. He could make smaller donations in many different places, which won't have the same splash, won't have the same impact. But maybe that's a way to go for different reasons. And indeed, the Rambam and the Bach on the side of the Torah, both took that position that it should be spread out. But the interesting thing is they have different reasons for taking that position. If you look at the Rambam in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, the Rambam understands that the reason he advocates giving out your tzedakah in smaller doses is because each act of tzedakah has an effect on your soul. That's part of the process of halachta b'dracha, part of the process of becoming like God. So every time you give a little bit of charity, every time you act in a generous fashion, it has an impact on you. So therefore, better to do it many times rather than doing it once, even though the one time would have been a bigger deal. The one time would have had a bigger impact. You want to focus on what it's doing to you at that time. And therefore, better to write out many smaller checks rather than one huge check. While the Bach, who also advocates spreading it out, but the Bach has a whole different reason. The Bach, in his commentary to Tur, in the Laws of Purim, when he talks about Matanos Lev Yonim, on Purim, we focus on giving out tzedakah. So the Bach says that it seems quite self-evident to him, the person who could give a lot of money to one person, or less money to many people, should give less to many people. He writes, because in doing so, he will have sustained many lives. So his focus is clearly different. They're coming to a similar conclusion from a different direction, that you will have an impact on more people. You'll apparently have a greater effect. His economic assessment, which you could argue with, but that seems to be his driving analysis, that his economic assessment is that the world will be better off if you give smaller gifts to many people rather than a big gift to one person in an asymmetrical fashion. So what do we see from that example? We see that here this similar conclusion of dividing up your contributions can come from two different places. It can come from the perspective of trying to advance your goal of making yourself into a divine personality of the halakha b'drachav, or it can come from a position of trying to have the greatest impact on the world, understanding that that's also coming from a mitzvah place as well. So a similar perspective can be brought to this issue. But on the one hand, so we take the perspective that we want to try to save the most life possible. That's an awkward grammatical formulation. Say the most life, meaning it's open to many different interpretations. The most lives, the most quality of life, the most duration of life. However, we're going to add up all the different factors. The most life possible, that's what we're trying to accomplish. While at the same time, we're also fulfilling a mitzvah for ourselves. And that may have its own set of rules and perspectives. And that the mitzvah that we're fulfilling, I think we have to understand, I think this is a theme that runs through medical ethics, is that we understand that ultimately HaKadosh Baruch Hu is making the decisions, and ultimately God is going to decide what lives are going to be saved, and how many will be saved, and in what setting, and in what context, and through which messengers. And our obligation is to honor the principle of life as much as possible, to do what we can through our commitment, through our devotion, through our attention, to honor the principle of pikuach nefesh, of saving lives, the value of human life, to the greatest extent that we can. So therefore, we take whatever actions we can that will show the greatest reverence, the greatest commitment to promoting and to preserving life through our devotions and through our activities. And they're not exactly the same thing. Now, that idea of fulfilling this mitzvah in the best way, of course, is again going to be affected by what will save the most life. That's how we're going to define it. But sometimes it's not going to be exactly the same thing. So, for example, we know that we have a principle of Yeharig Val Yavor, that there are certain things for which we have to give up our lives rather than violate. And one of them is murder. So we're not permitted to murder somebody else because we're under threat of death. Somebody says, shoot that person or I'll shoot you. So we're not permitted to do that. And the Gemara seems to understand this from a logical perspective, different possible sources for this idea. But the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that possibly the source for this idea is a simple point of logic, that my chazis edamach tedach, edamach tedach, tumaki tfei midamach tedach. How do you figure, how do you calculate that your blood is redder than his blood, that you're going to kill him to save your life, by what calculus do you come to that conclusion? Essentially saying it's a logical perspective. It doesn't make sense that your life is more valuable than the other person's, so you don't have a right to murder that person, to kill somebody else, in order to save your life. So on the one hand, there is a certain mathematical logic, a certain perspective of we're trying to preserve the most life, and it doesn't make sense for you to take somebody else's life in order for you to save your own. But we see from other sources that it's not purely mathematical. Because, for example, if I were to say to you, kill that one person, and you'll save your whole group, you'll save more than one person, so that mathematically you'll end up saving more lives by killing this one person. So we don't allow you to do that. That even though one can make the calculation that you're going to save more lives that way, nonetheless, we understand that an act of murder, an act of ritzicha, to shoot somebody else, is going to be such an offense against life, that the fact that it's going to add up in the end of the day, the way you hope, the way you assume is going to add up to more lives being saved, is not enough to justify it. So to give an example that's more in the Talmud more clearly, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, so there is a discussion, there is a debate, that if a band of marauders come to the town and say, turn over somebody, or we'll kill your whole town, so the Talmud tells us that we're not permitted to turn over any one person. And then there's a discussion that what if they don't just say a random person, but they happen to be looking for somebody specifically, and they say, give us Plony, give us that guy. So then there's a debate between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, whether or not you can do that. Maybe you can only do it if a person is taka deserving of death. Maybe you can't do it if it's an innocent person. So that's a whole debate, and it's not even clear how we rule on this. But what emerges is that even when the math doesn't add up, even when you'll be saving so many more lives, still there is a line that is drawn, that it's not simply informed by this mathematical analysis saying that you save the most lives, but we are obligated to show a certain reverence through our actions, and that reverence is going to include not crossing the line of actually killing someone, or turning over somebody to be killed, even if it's going to add up saving more life that way. And it's interesting that the Gemara there, the Yerushalmi there, has the expression which we find in many places. We find different versions of it in many places. But the idea basically being ein dochin nefesh b'fnei nefesh, that we don't push away one life in favor of another life, that we don't assume, again, you have the right to kill somebody to save your life. But in other contexts, so it's more possible that we're just talking about the math. We don't make a decision to give up one life to save another life. But in that context, it's clear we're talking about many more lives you'd be saving versus the one life, and that we'd have to understand that the principle of ein dochin nefesh b'fnei nefesh, at least from that context, and presumably from the other context then as well, is not simply about the math not pushing you in that direction. But even when it does, there is a line that we can't cross, because our commitment, our reverence for life, is going to draw the line in a certain place. So I think we have those type of lines. We're not allowed to commit murder. We're not allowed to hand somebody over for death. And then there's a gray area in the middle where there may also be such a line. But I think most of the realm, most of the arena in which we're talking about here, so then we're not talking about killing people, because that's not something we're allowed to do. So we're not making calculations about who we can kill and who we can't kill and how many people we can kill. But we're talking about our obligation to save lives. So how does our obligation to save lives match up in different situations, which is a function essentially of a number of different sources in the Torah, but perhaps most prominently the Pasuk Lo Samod Al Dam Re'echa, a Pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, which tells us that we're not allowed to stand by. Lo Tamod means don't stand, in the sense of don't stand still, don't stand by when somebody's life is at risk. So we're not permitted to do that. And our response, so instead of standing by, so we're going to do something. How are we going to decide what we're going to do, who we're going to do it for first, how we're going to do it? So that's part of our whole discussion. But that's a different realm. It's in that area, Losamod Al Dam Re'echa, where we're allowed to start making those calculations, rather than in the Los Tirzach, rather than in the category of don't murder, where things become much more black and white. But there could be an in-between area as well, and I think this is something that we'll see from some of the poskim, and it's a little bit more subjective, it's a little more vague, and I'm somewhat tentatively suggesting the distinction, that even, for example, within Lo Samod Al Dam Re'echa, there are probably different levels. So there's Lo Samod Al Dam Re'echa, don't stand by, when it's a case where you haven't done anything, where right now you're not doing anything for this patient, or a case where you're actively dealing with a patient, and you would stop dealing with that patient. And I think that would perhaps be a more active type of Lo Samod Al Dam Re'echa, where the rules might, again, be a little bit sharper. So we'll see, we'll discuss, and we'll have to see how much we have time to talk about. This is such a broad topic, but that there are poskim who are going to be very strong about saying that despite whatever other priorities we might define, so there's no right for a doctor to stop treating a patient in order to tend to a patient he may decide is a greater priority. And I think what's emerging from there, in addition to some other principles, is that it's kind of a more aggressive type of losam or dam riacha. There will be one type of amida, one type of standing still if you simply didn't get involved. It would be a more active type of standing still if you stood and stopped. If you stopped taking care of the patient in the middle, that would be something closer in the spectrum to the other side, where we might have to say that's not something that can be given over to the same calculus, and the rules are going to be different. So these are some introductory words. As we try to look a little bit at some of the sources, try to look a little bit at some of the ideas that we find in Chazal, that give us a little bit of perspective, a little bit of background, so that when we try to consider this very thorny, very difficult issue, we have somewhat of a context. So essentially, there are probably two passages in the Talmud, both very tricky, both very difficult. The second, in some ways, will seem more difficult than the first, which seem to touch upon this issue. On the one hand, there is a very well-known passage the Gemara has in Maseches Bava Metzia and Daf Samach Beis, where the Gemara discusses the situation of two people who were walking in a desert. And they don't have any water, they don't have enough water. It's a situation where their life is at risk, their lives are at risk because of the climate in the desert. And one of them has a bottle of water. He doesn't have enough for both of them to survive, he has enough for him to survive. He could hold on to his water and he could survive. Or he could split it with his friend. But then neither of them will really survive. So the Gemara records a debate on this point, that on the one hand, there is the position of Ben Patur. The Ben Patur says that they have to split the water, that even though this will result apparently in both of them dying, that's the appropriate approach. Al yira echa b'mitas chaveiro, that one should not see the other one dying, that because he's going to live at the expense of saving his friend's life, and he's going to watch his friend die, Rahman al-Aslam, because he is holding on to his water. So Ben Patur said that's inappropriate, he has to split the water, even though it's going to result in both of them not making it out of the desert. And Rabbi Akiva's position was different. Rabbi Akiva says, no, the Pasuk says, v'chei achicha imach, that your brother should live with you meaning you live first, and then you worry about making others live. So therefore, there is a principle, chayecha kodmim l'chayecha derecha, that your life takes priority, your life has to be the most important thing, then you can save other people's lives. So the assumption is that we adopted the view of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Shechter used to mention that he learned in college from the writings of Echad Ha'am, that Echad Ha'am had said that he thought Ben Patur, who we don't really hear about from the Talmud so much beyond this, he's very famous for this one discussion, but he's not a prominent figure like Rabbi Akiva is. Rabbi Akiva we hear about on every page of the Talmud, Ben Patur we don't hear about too much. Chada Ahmed apparently written that that's because he wasn't Jewish, that his perspective is a Christian perspective, this idea of self-sacrifice, that you should die so that you don't have to watch your friend die, that goes against everything in Judaism, and that's he wasn't even Jewish, he was Christian, that was the perspective. So that is not the traditional Orthodox perspective towards the Gemara. As Rabbi Shechter would go on to say, we don't take that position, we don't assume that he was Christian, we assume that he's Hale Gitana. But nonetheless, it seems to be that his position is not accepted as the final Jewish view. Even though there's a little bit of discussion, the Rambam is a little bit ambiguous, and there's some discussion in the Menchat Chinuch and Minskir Gadol and a Sefer Gadol's discussion, maybe the Rambam does take a different view, but we work under the assumption that Rabbi Akiva is the final word on this. So then the question is, what are we gleaning from this passage? What is this passage telling us? How much can be extrapolated to other situations? What principles are going to emerge from this discussion? So there are different analyses that we find in different Sfarim that are focused on different parts of the story. So for example, the writings of the Chazon Ish, for example, a number of others, Reb Unterman and the Shevet Mi'huda, and others take the view that what's going on here is the focus is on a balance between what we might call Chaye Olam and Chaye Shah, expression you find elsewhere in the Gemara, that you have the ability to save life in a temporary sense or in what sounds like a permanent sense. Of course, all of human life at this stage is temporary, but we mean, relatively speaking, that we could save somebody's life, that they can go on to pass this crisis and move on to a healthy life. Or we could save somebody's life for the moment, knowing that they're going to may remain within this problem and that ultimately they're going to still have to confront it. So those two different issues, Chai Olam and Chai Isha, so perhaps one could understand that the Gemara is essentially contrasting those two options. That either we could save the Chai Olam of the person who has the water, he could have enough water through this drink to make it out of the desert and go on to live his life normally, or we have a situation where we'll only save the Chai Isha of both of them. Both of them will drink half the water. They'll survive for a little bit longer. But then they won't make it beyond that. So they'll both die in the desert. Their lives will be saved a little bit more. And apparently what emerges from the Gemara is that we have the right to say that the Chai Olam of one of them is going to take priority over the Chai Isha of both of them. The ability to really save the life effectively of one of them is going to be more important. It's going to be more of our interest here than temporarily saving the lives of both of them. And that's an important principle, if that is indeed what we derive from here. It's a topic that a lot of the poskim discuss in different settings. Rav Moshe Sternbach has a tshuva from when he was living in South Africa, where he was confronted with a question. Somebody wrote to him that he was a doctor in the hospital in South Africa, and they just obtained a machine. I assume it's a respirator. It's a machine that can keep people alive. And at that time, this was a few decades ago, this was their one machine. It was very expensive. They just obtained it. And they have the following problem, that essentially they can only use it for one person at a time. And they work off the assumption, which as we'll see is probably the way poskim tend to relate to this, that you can't decide to take somebody off of it once he's on it. The person who's using it, you can't divert it to somebody else. So in general, the hospital is dealing with two categories of people. It's dealing with people who have the potential to live a long life beyond this and have their lives saved through this usage and then will go on to survive. And then people who are not able to really survive for much longer, and putting them on the machine is going to keep them alive a little bit, but ultimately, or sooner than ultimately, they're going to die. So the question is, if they're going to allow the patients who are not viable to be put on these machines, so then it could happen that an hour later a patient's going to come in who could have survived for a much longer time if he had access to this machine. And then what are they going to do? So they're not going to be able to put this patient on the machine. They only have one. They can't divert it from the Chai Isha patient to the Chai Olam patient. So the hospital had a policy that they don't allow the machine to be used by anybody other than the category of Chai Olam, the people who have potential to get better and to move on. Only those patients were allowed to use the machine. And the patients who didn't have a viable prognosis, the patients who weren't expected to survive, were not put on the machine in the first place. And he asked the question to Schermbach, is this an appropriate policy? Is this something that we can do? What about the fact that really we have an obligation of pikuach nefesh, which means that every temporary situation we also have to address. So a person who comes and we're only able to save their life for a day or two, so we're supposed to try to engage in that also. We have an obligation as well. So what right do we have to say to the patient who comes in, and so whether they're saying it out loud or not is a diplomatic question, which is also a part of the issue, but setting aside the question of saying it, but what right do we have to take the attitude towards this patient that we're not going to save the chai olam of this person because tomorrow a patient might come in who we could save his life in a more permanent sense? That was the question that the Rav Sternbach was asked, and he thought it was a very severe question, which he wanted to hear what the greater poskim had to say, but he did take the perspective that there is a legitimacy to this policy. We have to figure out exactly how to understand it, because on the one hand, we don't have the right to make calculations that we're going to say that we're going to divert our attention from one patient to another patient later on. But at the same time, maybe there is a fundamental distinction, maybe that can be derived from this Gemara, between the potential to really save somebody's life in the relatively permanent sense, while as opposed to the Chai Isha, the temporary saving of the life of a person who really is not viable at this point. He mentions in his tshuva that he looks forward to hear what the greater Gedolim had to say. So Rav Vosner in the tshuva Shevet Alevi has a tshuva addressed, it seems to be addressed to the same situation. It's also written to South Africa. It doesn't mention Rav Sternbach, but he mentioned South Africa, presumably it was the same situation. And he also, he goes back and forth a little bit, but also does seem to endorse this position as well in the context of discussing it. So he mentions that there is some halachic literature that does make a distinction in terms of saving lives between what's known as a treifa. A treifa we know from animals, from kashrus, but a treifa in the human sense is somebody who is unable to live for more than a year. He has a condition that will guarantee that he's not going to survive another 12 months, which Rav Moshe writes independently in a different shuva. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that that's probably the working definition as well of Chayi Olam versus Chayi Shah. That will say Chayi Olam is if you could save somebody and then there's a good chance, there's a reasonable chance they're going to live beyond the next year. And Chayi Olam would perhaps be anything less than a year, so it's essentially the same definition, what we call a treifa and not a treifa. So Vosner discusses some places in literature where there is a consideration that there might be a difference between a treifa and a not a treifa in terms of saving a life, in terms of the obligation of lo samar al dam riecha. There's a comment the Meiri has in his commentary to the Gemara in Sanhedrin where he seems to say that even though the Gemara we mentioned before because you can't turn over somebody to the marauders if they say, give us one person. But maybe you can if the person is already in the category of a treifa. There was even a view, you know, Rabbi Yehuda had a debate with Rav Shaya Pick Berlin, who maintained that the rule of Yehari Val Yavor, where the Gemara has this idea that your blood is not better than his, maybe that's not true if you're dealing with a treifa. It's questionable whether any of those views are actually accepted by halacha. The Yehari V'Yavor, for sure, it's questionable, very questionable. The Meiri's position is also questionable. All these positions are questionable, but it's all part of the discussion, and it's all part of the background. And Rav Vosner has in this discussion that maybe there is some room to justify such a discussion. But at the end of the day, it does seem to be that there is basis based on the Gemara in Bava Metzia, according to those who read it that way, that maybe the Gemara is telling us that we have the right to make this calculus that we could save one person Chayi Olam rather than saving more people in this category of Chayi Shah. So that is one of the possible lessons that might be derived from this Gemara. But there are also others who understood the Gemara differently. For example, the Maharsha, in his commentary to Bava Metzia, Reb Chaim Ozer seems to be getting at something like this as well, in Tshuva Sachiezer, Reb Chaim Ozer Brzezinski, that maybe the focus on the Gemara is not necessarily on evaluating those two balances together, Chayi Olam versus Chayi Shah, but maybe the focus on the Gemara is the fact that one of the two people is in possession of the water. One person has ownership of the water bottle, so the question is he allowed to maintain his possession of his bottle of water, or does he have to split it with his friend with the result that they will both die? So if that's the case, that kind of shifts the emphasis. And then the conclusion is all working off of the fact that one of them already has a prioritized connection to this resource because he owns it, because he's in possession of it, whatever that means. And that might lead to a different discussion. And it might mean that if a third party is making this decision, if a hospital, if a doctor is making this decision, maybe we don't necessarily have the right to assume that the Chayi Olam is going to take priority over the Chayi Shah. Maybe in such a setting where it's neutral, somebody else is making the decision, maybe the Chayi Shah is going to be prioritized. Then you're going to have to come up with a different situation, a different way of figuring out what comes first. Why should it be? It sounds a little bit unfair that if they're going to have this consequence that you could have saved somebody's life in a more enduring way and you're going to instead let him die sooner because of a temporary hatala for these two people. So it's a question, what exactly is behind that idea? The Nitziv, in his commentary to the Shiltis, the Nitziv of Elazhin, he wrote that the understanding of Ben Patur, the opinion that we don't seem to follow, is that he's not really assuming that both will die, even though it sounds like from the language of the Gemara that he is assuming that, but maybe he's hoping that something will happen in between, that if we're able to keep them both alive a little bit longer, so that who knows, that maybe the cavalry will show up, something will happen after they're kept alive a little bit longer, and that's our hope. So the idea of Chayi Shah in that setting, maybe it's not that it's really a definite Chayi Shah, the person has no hope of surviving further, but maybe the current situation doesn't give them hope of surviving further, but if we can keep them alive a little bit longer, maybe that will bring them to the next stage, and maybe our calculus is we'd rather do that rather than guarantee, so to speak, whatever that means, guarantee one person's longer life, and say the other one has to give up hope right now. And that if that's the view of Ben Patur, it could also be the view of Rabbi Akiva if we take this understanding that Rabbi Akiva only said his opinion because one of them was in possession and that a neutral party who is giving out resources without priority for one party or the other maybe would have to revert to the default position of Ben Patur and maybe that's what's behind it. So there are various points that can be gleaned from how we understand this debate that it's not something that we have a definitive resolution on. It gives us a little bit of perspective, some of the different issues that can be seen from there. There's also a discussion, an extensive literature, on what exactly do we mean when the Gemara concludes Chayecha Kodmin, this idea that your life comes first, that you're able to prioritize, you're obligated to prioritize your life, so is that absolute? So any of your needs come before any of anybody else's needs, or only when they're equivalent needs? That's also a discussion, and it's something that we don't have necessarily such a straight answer to. On the one hand, the Radbaz, in his Tshuvas, so he maintains that one is not obligated, not only is one not obligated to give up his life to save somebody else, we'll discuss that in a moment from the Radbaz, but even less than his life, a person is not obligated to give up a limb. So let's say a person is told that he could agree to have his hand cut off, and that will save somebody else's life. So the Radbaz assumes that he has no such obligation to do that. In contemporary halachic literature, that position of the Radbaz has been adopted in the discussion of living organ transplants, when people could have the option of donating an organ, not necessarily from a cadaver, but a person that's going to continue living. So do we assume that that's an obligation? Do you have an obligation to give up an organ in order to save somebody else's life? So much of the literature draws upon this Radbaz. One could argue whether or not it's parallel. There are differences between giving up a hand and giving up an internal organ. Could be different, could be the same, could be comparable, could be not be comparable, but much of the literature draws upon that, which is one element of the discussion where we say your needs are prioritized over your requirement to help somebody else. He also discusses the fact that there happens to be a debate between the Talmud Yerushalmi and the Talmud Bavli, that even though it's generally agreed that you don't have to, or you're not permitted to sacrifice your life to save somebody else's life, it's a question whether you're allowed to put yourself at risk to save somebody else's life. Can you engage in a suffix sakana in order to save somebody else's life? So the Talmud Yerushalmi seems to say that yes, so you should, you're obligated to engage in a suffix sakana to put your life at risk if it's not definite that you're going to die. And the Talmud Bavli, which apparently we paskin like, seems to take the view that no, you're not obligated to put your life at risk to save somebody else's life. And the Rabbis went further. The Rabbis thought that it was actually wrong, that even if a person wanted to be a tzaddik, a person wanted to be noble and say, I'm going to put myself at risk to save others, he thought that that was not an appropriate chumrah. And he understood that the respect you have to have for your own life, the preservation you have to have for your own life, even from the perspective of a suffix, is going to outweigh the ability to definitely save somebody else's life. So, for example, if Tzitz Eliezer has a discussion, so let's say somebody has a possibility of some illness. He doesn't know that he really has it. And the doctor tells him if he takes a certain rare medicine, that will address the situation. He's able to obtain this medicine. And he has a friend who definitely has this illness and for sure needs this medicine. So the Rabbis could be extrapolated to discuss, does this person have an obligation to give the medicine over? The monetary issues aside, you could talk about separately, but does he have the opportunity, the obligation to provide this medicine to the person who definitely has the illness? So we assume that the definite illness takes priority over the possible illness. So even though the Prima Gaudium was of the opinion that that's a general policy, the doctors should prioritize those who are definitely sick over those who are possibly sick, because we say Ein Safek Motzi Midei Vadai, that something that is uncertain cannot take priority over something that's certain. But the Rabbi says here, the Chayecha Kodmin principle, so that takes priority. That's something that is going to give an edge, and therefore that individual should hold on to medicine for himself, even though he is less definitely in need of it than the person to whom he was going to give it. One of the limited resources that we deal with this morning is the limited time for this discussion, so there's so much more to say. I'll just say a few quick other words just to kind of illustrate some of what's out there. I'm a little bit saved by the bell because it'll enable me not to discuss one of the more difficult sugyas of the Gemara, which we're probably all familiar with. There's a Mishnah in Maseches Horias which talks about prioritizing within individuals. We won't, in the interest of time, go into all the different priorities that the Mishnah lists, but there is part of the discussion as to what extent that is adopted into practice today. It's noteworthy that, for the most part, we don't really see it put into practice, and no one's really advocating it directly put into practice. Poskim talk about it to different degrees. It's Tzitz Eliezer and his Tshuvas, he assumed that we don't poskim like that Gemara. He has a proof that the Gemara is talking about something else. The Gemara is talking about tzedakah, is not talking about saving lives. So some of the poskim understood that's the case. It's only relevant to tzedakah. It's not relevant to saving lives. And Tzitz Eliezer understood it's not even relevant to tzedakah. It's relevant to tzedakah, but there's a Gemara that contradicts it, so we don't poskim like that Gemara. So that's one approach. While others, such as Reb Shlomo Zalman and Reb Moshe Feinstein, understood that that it was relevant to saving lives, but in practice it's not really relevant. And in practice there are many, many other issues to concern ourselves with, that it's only when we really have no other way of deciding between two patients that it's going to come up. But in general, most poskim talk about issues of maximizing chance of success versus maximizing, that's one issue, also maximizing greatest need, the people who need you the most, that's going to be the highest priority. Those are two of the elements that poskim talk about. And they also emphasize both Reb Moshe and Shlomo Zalman in different ways, that Reb Moshe basically endorsed a first-come, first-served policy that, for the most part, it's going to be very hard for the doctor to figure out some of these other issues. So therefore, those who come to his attention first are, for the most part, really going to be those who are prioritized. And once that situation is there, we can't really divert from that for very few reasons to justify diverting from that. But Moshe mentions that if you're already treating a patient, so then that patient, so to speak, already acquires the slot, so to speak, and therefore that already jumps over most other priorities. He also mentions just practically that if a patient is going to perceive that, let's say you're going to make a decision that the second patient has a better chance of survival. So this patient that you're treating now, that patient's going to see you leave him because you've made the decision that the next patient has a better chance of survival. That could have such a debilitating effect on the morale and on the ability to fight of the first patient. That's also something to take very seriously, that a patient or his family shouldn't see that you are making this decision, and that's something that he took very seriously. Reb Shlomo Zalman also had a similar perspective, that without focusing on who arrives first, but focusing more on who you attend to first, that if you're already involved in working on one patient, that he felt very strongly that that did not allow you to divert to another patient, even if other factors maybe would have indicated as such, even if before you started getting involved, there were other decisions to make, that that factor wouldn't necessarily come into play. Rav Chaim Hirschenson, I think we're ready, almost over time, let's mention one or two other points. Rav Chaim Hirschenson, who wrote the Shuvas Malki B'Kodesh, has a commentary to the Gemara Maseches Horius. He has a long discussion about this, where he also suggests that part of the equation is going to be the ability of the individual to fight for themselves. In the situation, he talks about the Titanic a little bit, you have a situation where people are stronger, able to fight for themselves, that's also part of the equation. So that also has to be added in. If you have a situation where people are completely helpless and other people can do something to try to save themselves a little bit but need help, so the helpless people come before those people who need help. And in that setting, so he notes, and it's part of the whole complexity of this issue, so an individual being stronger cuts both ways. So if one potential savee is stronger, so on the one hand, they have a better chance of survival, so they should be prioritized for that reason because they're stronger. But on the other hand, they also may have a better ability to save themselves, and then they'll have a less of a priority. So part of the complexity of this issue is that the same quality, the same trait, can point in two different directions because of the different elements that we're taking into this equation. And I'll just mention maybe one other issue, because I don't want to go too much over time, but part of also the complexity and the severity of this issue, one issue that many poskim discuss, and this is part of where I want to come as a student and put it before the room, because this is an issue where I think it's possible to take a very different stance towards. So some poskim considered the question of Rahman al-Assad was very relevant during the time of the Holocaust and other comparable settings. The question of, let's say you have a person who is currently at risk of imminent death. Let's say the Nazis have him and they're going to kill him or something like that. And you have the ability to save his life. You can bribe a guard. You can do something that's going to make a difference. But you also know that they have a quota. So if you save this person, they're going to take somebody else. Somebody else will then be put to replace them. And so essentially, by saving this person, you're causing somebody else to die. So many poskim were confronted with this question then and at other points in history. Is that something that is appropriate to do? Are you essentially, is that a category of ein docha nefesh b'fnei nefesh? Essentially, you're trading one life for another. So is that something that we can allow you to do? And of course, that's a question of devastating severity. It's not something any of us ever want to be confronted with. And there were poskim who took that attitude. It's just beyond us. But it does seem that there are many who lean towards saying, ein docha nefesh b'fnei nefesh, we can't trade one life for another. I would submit to the crowd that maybe one could take the opposite approach, that essentially the question of the calculus of how things are going to end up, that is beyond us, that's in God's hand. Our obligation is to show reverence for life by saving lives to the greatest degree that we can, by engaging in Hatzalah. And I would think that if you have the ability to save this person's life, So what happens after that, hopefully they won't move on to somebody else, but if they do, at least you've delayed that process, at least you've added an extra step, and that as far as your obligation towards Hatzalah, it would seem to be that you're obligated to save the life that you can save in front of you, and hope that a miracle will happen before the next stage goes on. It seems to be comparable to the question that's popular in current philosophy. The Chazon Ish talked about this question of, it's variously called the trolley question, the rocket question. Let's say you know that you see a group of people who are at risk of death. There's a missile coming in their direction. They're in a trolley that's about to crash, and you can save their life. You can knock the missile into a different path. You can knock the trolley into a different path that's safer. But in doing so, there's one person who's not at risk, and that person will be put at risk by your actions. So essentially, there's one person right now who's not at risk, you're going to be causing that person to die. But in doing so, you'll save 10 people who are at risk. So do we say you're permitted to do that? So that's a question that philosophers struggle with tremendously. You find that throughout the literature, throughout the secular and halakhic literature. And the Chazon Ish took the perspective in his comments to Sanhedrin, Rav Asher Weiss, in his Shiurim and Sefer Dvarim, very approving of this position, that the Chazon Ish thought it was permissible to divert the course, because the consequence that one person is going to die is, of course, highly terrible, but the fact is the action that you are doing is an act of hatzalah, it's an act of life-saving, and the fact is that you hope that you can save that person's life too, but you are engaged in saving lives of as many people as you can, and that's the prism through which we see it. So I think in this case, certainly one could take the perspective that you are saving the life of the person in front of you, and that's your primary responsibility, which then goes back to the way we started, that ein docheh nefesh b'fnei nefesh presumably really means that it's our obligation to show the greatest reverence to life through our actions, to do what we can to make sure that all of our commitments, our activities, and our energies are devoted towards saving the most life possible and respecting that principle to the greatest degree. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu should save us. He is in control of what actually happens, and we ultimately humbly submit to His will. So there's much, much more to say about this, but we'll just quickly review what we spoke about. We spoke about a little bit about some of the complexity of this question, how ultimately it's going to be a judgment call. It's going to be something that we have to have a discretion that's used, comparable in that way to tzedakah, where there are halakhic principles, but in the end of the day, there is a decision-making process that is going to be ambiguous. And we mentioned that just as we find tzedakah, so there are two different motivating factors, the desire to have the greatest impact, but also the desire to create the halachta b'drachta, to create divine souls. So too, when it comes to life-saving, we want to save the most life, whatever that means, but we also want to honor the principle of saving lives as much as we can, which is going to mean sometimes different types of conclusions. That's why we can't kill somebody, even if it means we're going to save more lives. And it means even less actively, for example, the Yerushalmi and Trumas, we can't turn over one person to be killed, even if it means the whole city is going to be killed, and there's only a debate if that one person is both named and perhaps guilty, so then there's a discussion that maybe it could be permissible. So that illustrates the fact that we have this line that we can't cross, even if the math might indicate a different way, showing again these two different values from which we, two different priorities that we're trying to keep in balance. And then we suggested the in-between stage, well, Salmar al-Damriach, we can't stand by. There's different types of standing by. You could stand by and not get involved, or you could stand by and stop treatment, which would be more objectionable, more of a line that some of the poskim thought was an issue, perhaps further along that point in the spectrum. And then we discussed a little bit some of the sources. We discussed the fact that there is this well-known Gemara in Bava Metzia about the two people in the desert. One has water, and according to Rabbi Akiva, he's not obligated to split it. According to Ben Petur, he is obligated to split it. We discussed a little bit the question of what principle is gleaned from that. Is the Gemara telling us perhaps that the Chayi Olam takes priority over the Chayi Shah, the ability to live a longer life is going to take priority over a temporary life? Discussed the Rishterbach's question about the respirator usage as an example of that, and the whole analysis that Rav Vazna had of that situation. And then we discussed other ways to see that Gemara, the Maharsha and the Achiezer, who understand it as focusing on the fact that the one who has the water is in possession, and therefore maybe a neutral third party would not have the same equation, and how that affects the discussion. And then we mentioned the Nitziv's understanding of the Gemara, that the idea of Chayi Olam and Chayi Shah is also hopefully in the interest of Chayi Olam, that maybe if we keep them alive longer, they will have more of a chance to find the Yeshua, which may also indicate a different path in different circumstances. And then we talked about a little bit about some of the principles derived from the idea of Chayecha Kobrim. What does it mean to say your life comes first? You mentioned the Rabbaz's discussion, whether you have to give up a limb to save somebody else's life, or whether you are even permitted to risk your life to save somebody else's life. and the discussion of how that enters into the equation, the possible saving of your life versus the definite saving of somebody else's life, and the differences between that question when it's your resources versus somebody else's resources. And then we discussed mercifully briefly the discussion of Gemara and Horius, which talks about ranking different people, the question of whether or not that's practiced the halacha, the perspective of some of the poskim that it's actually only talking about staka, it's not talking about life saving, the perspective of other poskim that we don't paskim like that Gemara, and the perspective of other poskim that in theory it's true, but it's really the last calculus and other equations such as who can who needs the help most or who has the best chance of success comes first. And we emphasize Rav Moshe's idea of a first come first serve policy essentially, and where he also noted that if you divert your attention you're both taking away from the right of that patient and also possibly devastating his morale. The position of Rav Shlomo Zalman that you can't divert once you've already started working on a patient, and that the Mishnah Horius only comes in at the very, very end when there's nothing else, in the position of the Prima Gadim, that somebody who's definitely sick is going to take priority over somebody who is actually sick. And then we just mentioned the whole question of Rav Chaim Hirschenson's position, where he talks about people who have more of a position to save themselves are going to be differently placed, how some elements, like the element of physical strength, is going to cut both ways, giving a person a higher chance of success, but also a greater ability to save themselves, showing how even the same quality could put them into a different direction. And then we just ended off by mentioning the question the philosophers talk about whether you're allowed to save somebody's life when you know that then that person will be replaced by somebody else in risk of death, and are you allowed to do that? The attitude that some poskim had, that was not permissible, that was an example of Ein Dochen Nefesh B'Nefesh, and we suggested that it might be possible to look at it differently, that it might be possible to say that you are engaged in an act of life-saving, and that's your primary responsibility. What happens after that is in the hands of God, comparable to the position the Chazon Ish took, that you have the right to divert the danger from a group of people, even if it means you'll be putting a new individual in danger, or one individual versus a group. That would be permissible because you're engaged in an act of Hatzalah, and the rest, as Hashem, we put in the hands of God. Thank you very much. Questions? Everybody come? We have time for questions? It's up to Rabbi Kelman. Sorry, I guess you'll be in charge of the question. Oh, the respirator.
The question of the respirator was when that patient who can only live a very limited amount of time, and then he's on the respirator and another patient comes in, he could live for a longer period of time if he were on the respirator, and the fact that we can't remove the patient that's currently on the respirator, would it be allowed to remove in any case of patients that multiple categories that I saw to put him on a respirator on a timer?
So that is a discussion. So Rav Sternbuch discusses that possibility, and from a halachic perspective, there's a lot of advantage to that. From a halachic perspective, where we do focus very much on actions and non-actions, so that's the question. Did everyone hear the question? You know, the question was the working assumption that you can't take a patient off a respirator to put a more viable patient on a respirator, but what if instead of doing that, so since the policy in the hospital in South Africa was not to even get involved with a respirator because they didn't want to have to confront that question of taking the less viable patient off the respirator, what if the respirator is on a timer so that they can revisit the question every day or so when your timer goes off, and then it wouldn't necessarily be a question of stopping one treatment to save another person, it'd be a question of looking at the issue anew each day. So the truth is, halachically, we do find weight to that, and Rav Sternbuch does discuss that possibility. He thought that practically it's not going to work, especially if you're dealing with families. You're not going to be able to tell a family, the same issue you would have with telling the family of the Chayishah patient, we're taking your relative off to accommodate somebody who's more viable. It's not going to make a difference to say to them, well, we had it on a timer, so you shouldn't feel worried about it because we're not actually turning it off. It went off by itself. They're not going to be said practically, even though there is some value to that suggestion, it wasn't a viable option for what they were dealing with. So the answer on one level is yes, there is something to that. Practically speaking, it was questionable how much of a difference it was going to make. Sorry, I didn't hear. So blood donations are have much less of an issue to it. You know, that's something where the individual is able to save lives and really does not pose much of a risk of any, or the average healthy person does not experience much of a risk in making such a donation. So it's pretty much, in terms of major factors, all upside. So we would assume that would be mitzvah rabba, as we say. That would be highly recommended, if not obligatory, possibly obligatory, but certainly something that is very highly laudable. In general, there's a question when it comes to living organ donations: how do we balance whatever risk is going to happen to the donor versus the benefit that he will be giving to whoever is going to receive? When it comes to blood, I think the balance is really not much of a question. You know, there are internal organs which will create much more of a risk for the person, and then there's a whole discussion in post-com, how do we evaluate percentages, statistics, what's too much of a risk, what's a category where it's optional, where you can decide you can take this risk, where you're obligated to, you're not obligated to. So there's much in the middle which is much more complicated. I don't think the blood poses that kind of a complication. I think we assume it's a tremendous mitzvah. As pretty much, as far as large concerns are there, pretty much only an upside.
I think we all realize we're running quite late, and we are learning, but I think we'll take two more questions, and if we can really limit to that. So we have two that caught my eye here and here, and I apologize to anyone else. Okay, so just the last two questions, please.
Let me ask, is there any role in halakhah for sort of a, if you will, a mishum eva concept? In other words, just by analogy, I once had a patient who had experimental liver transplant, was drunk, died, Hosek wouldn't allow a postmortem. And the transplant surgeon said that if that's to be the policy, usual orthodox patients will not get livers on an investigational basis because they have to find out what's going on. So just set as background. Analogously, with the allocation of resources, if it is known that orthodox patients won't relinquish finite resources when it is clear that their survival is not expected, if that has an impact on future access, for example, to ICU or advanced high level care, is there a sort of societal meta halakha to consider that going to the calculus at all?
So that's a very complicated question, probably for an overtime question, maybe too complicated. I think what you're referring to is something specific, because in general you do find Ava playing a big role, but I think when you talk about giving up finite resources, it sounds like the issue you're talking about is brain death, or the issue of a patient giving up an organ when they're still alive. Is that the...
General ethic in a hospital is if somebody is elderly with an advanced complicated multi-system disease, most of the doctors don't rank after the ICU, and most of the patients don't after the ICU. But if it happens to be a patient whose mindset is high isha, they want the ICU, you can just see the eyes roll back of the ICU, of the intensivist, and see you coming down the hall, okay, here you can request a patient a bed in the ICU for this patient, and then once they're there forever. It becomes difficult to sell a proposition of even gaining access to the ICU because of a certain mindset that we share, which is not common in the hospital.
So the question would be, whose perspective is your perspective? You are the doctor who gets to decide how things are allocated, and you're going to choose one patient's chai shov over the other patient's chai olam. So it's assuming that is the halakhic conclusion. So here we see that that's not necessarily the conclusion. So I wonder, it depends how it's presented and how it's handled, whether or not it has to result in an Ava type of situation if it's not presented as such a particularistic type of perspective, that if it's presented in more secular neutral terms in terms of the analysis and the policy, especially to the extent to which there may be indeed overlaps. You know, certainly the Mishnah in Horius is not something that can really be implemented, and no one's really suggesting implementing that in an American hospital setting or even an Israeli hospital setting. So certain things which are more overtly orthodox, so to speak, are not really part of the equation. So I think the elements that are, as we see, are not really so definite and are part of a lot of analysis. So I think there's room, again, I'm speaking very, very surfacely and without the experience that you have, but I think that there probably is room to incorporate this thinking in such a way that it doesn't have to result in such a culture clash that there's going to be a ban on Orthodox patients. I could be wrong, but I think my push is that there is room to incorporate this type of thinking in a way that is understandable to a non-Jewish mindset, in a way that can be part of a debate where it wouldn't have to create such a blatant culture clash, I would hope. Okay, thank you very much.